Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Well, welcome everyone. My name is Chris Keneally. I really appreciate your joining us here for an event sponsored by the National Writers Union in Boston and the steering committee of which I am a member. I'm also the host of a program we call Beyond the Book at Copyright Clearance Center. And joining me today is Saunders Robinson. Welcome, Saunders.
Thank you.
Saunders received her B.A. in Classics from Northwestern University and her M.A. in Writing, Literature, and Publishing from Emerson College here in Boston. She's worked as a freelance writer and editor for local newspapers in Memphis, Tennessee. And upon receiving her master's, she worked for Allen & Bacon as an editorial assistant in communications and as a freelance development editor. Saunders began working with the History Press in 2007 as one of the founding commissioning editors for the company's Northeast office, which is based in Salem, Massachusetts. She is now the senior commissioning editor and Northeast publisher, which sounds all really very sort of highfalutin. And you're going to tell us how you got into this at some point and tell us a bit more about History Press. But from the website, which is at historypress.net, we learned that it's based in Charleston, South Carolina, a city rather like Boston in some ways, very historic. History Press publishes high-quality history and heritage titles that seek to bring to life the past in a variety of areas across the United States. And you're attempting to bring a new way of thinking to history publishing, to seek out history and heritage titles that are written by historians capable of making their area of expertise understandable to a wide audience, and that's going to be something we'll get into, and just, you know, how you help them achieve that goal. And what's interesting about this is just the way that, despite the national interest in history, especially regional history, the book business has frankly underserved this area in the past, and so the History Press is attempting to kind of balance that by providing books that seek audiences that exist but have been overlooked in the past. And I think as somebody who's written a history book or two, this is interesting to me. And, you know, when I've spoken about history, Saunders, people have asked me, what was I trying to do? And I say, well, I remembered being in history class in high school. And, you know, at some point, everybody said, oh, history was just names and dates. But names and dates don't make history. People make history.
Absolutely. And I would say that names and dates are not necessarily the most accessible way of delivering history to a reader. And that's something that we really focus on, is telling the story and engaging readers in that way. So,
yeah, well, I'm looking forward to going into that, but give us you know, a quick 30 seconds on the History Press. What have been some recent titles that have done well for the company, and you know, in particular, some titles you may have published yourself?
So I think the first thing to point out is that we're publishing local and regional history books, and our books are really intended for a local audience, and that's what we're always keeping in mind whenever we make a decision to publish a book. So while larger publishers who are catering toward a national audience may think that a book like Duck Hunting on Currituck Sound would be a ludicrous book to do, that it's certainly not going to be a worthwhile investment, we see value in that. There is, in fact, a very strong duck hunting community in Currituck Sound, which is, I believe, on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. The book is written by a local duck hunter. It is, you know, they're his stories. They're stories that he experienced as a child growing up with a father who was a duck hunter and having a son as a duck hunter, and there is a very real community there that identifies with it. And that book has been a great success for us. So while it may come as a surprise to other publishers, it doesn't to us, because we're aware that there really is that market that's going to identify with it.
So you're really looking for not only authors with stories to tell, but authors who have communities that they can connect to. And they can be very esoteric, but this is a big country.
Absolutely. And I would say that the authors are a part of the community that they're writing about. That's really important. We're not looking for someone who is an outsider telling someone else's story. If you're writing a history of Somerville, Massachusetts, you should be from Somerville. If you are writing a history of food, drink, and celebrations of the Hudson Valley Dutch, you should be Dutch, and you should be a food historian, and Peter Rose is that, and that's why this book has been successful. She knows her community, she's a part of it, she can be an advocate for it, and she knows how to reach that audience.
Well, what is it about history these days? We live in a very fast-moving society. You would think that history doesn't matter. History is yesterday and the day before. But yet you're talking, that cover there seems to indicate a time from, the days of Rip Van Winkle or something back in the 18th century. So what is the attraction for readers in history, do you think?
Well, for us, because we're talking about local history, I think, and that's an important distinction for us to make, the importance is, especially at a time where we're losing our local newspapers, our mom and pop businesses are going out of business, and people are really struggling to find their own kind of, well, rather, they're really struggling to maintain and hold on to those establishments that made their community. Books that explore a community's history and celebrate it reinforce that identity. And I think that's why our books are successful, because in a way it's reinforcing, the reader's own identity as well as the community in which he or she lives.
Right, kind of a shared sense of place. I'm looking at some titles that are on our table here, and we may come back to Duck Hunting on Currituck Sound just because it's so unusual a title. But there's another one here that sounds like an oxymoron. There's the New England Cookbook. And one doesn't really associate New England cooking, or New England with cooking, I should say. But tell me what that's about.
Well, so it's interesting. We thought that this book would be really successful. It's got a great cover. It is very quirky. It has all sorts of funny recipes for if you're sick, an invalid's diet, a lot of stuff that's very charming.
Oh, I see. It's a reprint, actually, of an original book from, it says here, a collector's edition of the 1905 classic. Yeah.
Exactly. And we thought that this would, do quite well. Well, in fact, although we had a foreword by Annie Copps, who is the food editor for Yankee Magazine, this book did not get as much traction as we thought that it would, whereas a book like the Hudson Valley Dutch, and of course this year is the year of the Hudson, but with a book like this book did quite well. And I think a lot of the huge factor in the success of the book was the author and the author's relationship to her community. So it makes a huge difference. The author is crucial to the book's success. If you have, if you have the wrong person telling Camden, Maine's history, people aren't going to buy the book. They want to know, well, Barbara Dyer's the local historian. Why is so and so telling our history? It's our history.
So it's a matter of authenticity that really you're looking for.
And credibility as an insider.
Right. So we're going to talk about some of the requirements you have that go beyond just that sense of authenticity. You've got online a publication proposal form that we might walk through, because I think that'll be very interesting for authors. And it seems to me that the kind of author you might be looking for could range from, you know, a very serious and very well-experienced journalist or academician to somebody who's just a local historian who may never have thought of themselves as a writer before, but is, you know, well-versed on the subject and capable of telling a good story.
Absolutely. Our authors really run the gamut. I mean, what the most important quality is to be an active participant in your community.
So how do you find these authors? How do you get the word out that you're looking for these types of books? And talk about that process.
Well, I will say that we have a very active commissioning staff. In fact, that's what my office focuses on. Because as you said, many people, many local historians that we work with maybe don't think of themselves as a writer. And in fact, they are the person who knows the most about their community's history. So you have to be very active in pursuing them. And we reach out to local historical societies. We're on the HNET listserv, where local historians are talking about various topics all day long, talking to the local newspapers and finding out who's active in the community, who is writing about history, talking to the local librarians and finding out who's coming into the local history room and doing research. So it's very active. It's not acquisitions as much as it is commissioning locals to tell the story.
And I can imagine that the web is making that job a bit easier.
Absolutely. In fact, sometimes my colleague and I wonder how our business would even exist without the internet, with the amount of communication that goes into just securing that one book. You may have you may have 8 to 10 conversations just to find someone to do a particular book that you want.
Right, and yet I can imagine if you're covering the Northeast, still a fair amount of travel, because the real interaction with the historical societies, with the authors, with the communities, still counts even for you and your editorial staff.
It does, but I will say that most of the communication that goes on is really over the phone and over email. So, with certain communities, that in-person meeting is what is going to make the difference. You know, it's cultural. In certain states, it's different. It just really kind of depends.
And you worked first in the office in Charleston, is that right?
No, actually, I've always worked in the Northeast office. I came into the Salem office as an editor.
Okay, I was just wondering whether there's been any. Have you noticed that the way that things go down in South Carolina are perhaps different than the way that things work up here in New England, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, I will say that there seems to our authors and potential writers tend to become very depressed in the winter,
uh-huh.
And so we see a lot of deliveries falling away. I will say that my experience has been that New Englanders are a little more reserved. They don't necessarily just want to talk to you on the phone just because you want to talk to them. You know, you may have to send them a couple of letters, follow up with a phone call, send them some more letters, show them, you know, what their book could potentially look like, and then maybe they want to talk to you.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I can identify with that. We're more private. What should an author do to prepare a winning proposal? And I alluded to the online availability of a publication proposal. We can walk through that if you'd like. But are there some real basics even before you sit down with the proposal?
Absolutely. I think one important part is is just the description of your book, and often just even letting us know what you're proposing for a title, because that oftentimes gives us a really good idea of what you're thinking your book is. Also including a table of contents is really helpful, because I found that often the 100-word description that you may give of your book can be very different than your table of contents. And your table of contents often reflects something entirely different, whereas you may think that your book is very chatty and accessible, and then the table of contents might reflect otherwise. So it also makes it easier for an editor to quickly respond to you, because they've got the framework of the book. Sending one sample chapter is helpful, or a portion of it, rather than sending the entire manuscript, just because editors have only so much time to kind of assess the viability of the project. You want to make it as easy for them as possible, as digestible as you can.
Well, I'm looking at the form here, and there are questions about previous works published, affiliations with historical organizations, societies, and museums. If you haven't published in the past, listing similar projects that have, you know, kind of touched on the same kinds of research. So you're looking for some experience. You're looking for somebody. You're looking for someone to demonstrate what you were speaking about before: access to the right information, authenticity, all of that.
Activity. You know, maybe you haven't written before, but you've done several exhibits for the museum, or you know, you work on the newsletter, but maybe you haven't written for it. What we're not looking for is someone who is just in town writing their thesis and wants to publish their book and is then going to be, you know, isn't going to be there when the book comes out and be there to promote it. So we're really looking for, you know, are you a part of the community? Are you on the Chamber of Commerce? Are you organizing the 4th of July parade? You know, are you engaged locally?
Right. And you know, you had told me when we were chatting about this beforehand that some of the structure at History Press is very much traditional in terms of how you pay your authors, how you work with your authors. But what you're describing is something that's much more the new model of the relationship between the publisher and author. In the past, the author kind of delivered the book in manuscript form and waited until, you know, the galleys came and had a launch party and all of that. But you're really looking for authors who are prepared to be partners with you in the whole piece of it, right? Not only writing the book, but the sales and the marketing and all of that.
In a way, those are the books those are the books that tend to sell the best. But I would say that, you know, it's a function of the audience that we're trying to reach. So if locals identify with you and know you, you're a part of community building, then they are going to buy the book.
Right, and it seems to me that history, you know, I wonder, are there certain niches? Again, I'm looking at the variety of titles here, and it's fascinating. You've got Connecticut Baseball, the Best of the Nutmeg State. Mm-hmm. Now, that would be something that would appeal to people in Connecticut, but if you're a baseball fanatic, baseball is a global sport these days, and there may be characters who came out of Connecticut that I've just got appealing stories for anybody in the world. So therefore your audience there is people in Connecticut, but it's also baseball fans.
Right. And what I would say is, you know, we're really catering to very specific targeted audiences. You know, it's a niche really. You know, there are people who love Connecticut baseball and are very proud of that. They've never gotten a book. John Harrison has been covering them for 40 years and following the players, following the games, and is very passionate about it. And this book is doing really, really well. And who would have thought that Connecticut baseball would do well? But there's a group of people that have never, you know, who have never been identified as a group, although they've identified as a group
kind
on
of on their
own.
Right,
right,
but they haven't had a kind of recognition, I guess is what you mean.
Right, because it just wouldn't be a large enough group for a publisher to cater to.
Well, it seems to me that that a book can convey that. It gives people a sense that they've been recognized. You know, we're at a moment in book publishing where, you know, there's all talk about the digital revolution and everything's moving onto, you know, ebook readers and Kindles and certainly online. But there's still something about the actual artifact of a book that really counts, that counts as a gift, that counts as a memento, that almost kind of speaks to achievement, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I would say that, you know, one important part of the physical book for us is that there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of sentimental value and identity wrapped up in our books. And so people want to possess that physical book. And as we move into the digital age, I'm not quite sure how our books will fit in that way. So we'll see.
Well, I'm pretty confident the book's going to survive. I mean, as a real book, you know, at Copyright Clearance Center, we do some surveys on this, and we've been asking people the question, you know, what's going to survive, what's going to die, and the range of things goes from the scientific journal to the newspaper and so forth and so on, all the way to the book. And the last time I looked at one of these surveys, the book almost got 100% expectation that it will survive, you know, the actual book itself. People think newspapers are dead. People think scientific journals are dying, magazines and all of that. But books, people seem to have an expectation they're going to survive. So I'm optimistic myself about that. But for authors who have grown up in this culture where success is defined in millions, right, best-selling and all of that, while there are books that are successful for History Press, I think it's fair to say we're not talking about New York Times bestsellers here.
No.
And so really there's a difference between a large audience and a right audience. And how do you help authors set their expectations?
In terms of the audience that we're hoping to reach,
right? And you know what's successful? I mean, you know, if they publish the memoir of Bill Clinton, successful is 5 million copies sold the first day or whatever it was. But if you publish a book on Connecticut baseball, what's successful there?
I would say about 1,500 to 2,000 copies in the first year would be really successful for our books. We're not looking at huge print runs. We're able to go back to press very easily. There's no need to overprint, and because you know we're very targeted, both with our printing, with our audience. It's a model that does work. You know, we're not having to print 100,000 copies and kind of hope that, you know, a small percentage buys the book. We know exactly where they are.
Right. But I've been influenced by a book that I read a few years ago called So Many Books, which took a look at what it said was reading and writing in an age of abundance, you know, and there are so many books published these days and so many people who want to be authors. So you hear like a number 1,500 or 2,000 copies, and you think, well, that doesn't sound like much. But there's statistics that say that the average book in this country sold fewer than 500 copies in a single year. So that's three or four times the average, you know, sale. So you're doing quite well at that point. And it's good to hear that. Tell us about some books that have surprised you. You kind of alluded to that. You know, the Hudson Valley Dutch book on food and celebration has done well, but the New England cookbook didn't do well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some other examples, because that'll help people get an idea of what works, what doesn't work.
Absolutely. Well, again, Duck Hunting on Currituck Sound, an example of a book that might be a surprise for a lot of people, was not a surprise for us. We have this book, Under the Clock, The Story of Miller and Rhodes. This is about a dry goods store that eventually became a very important department store in, I believe, Richmond. And I'm not sure when it closed. I think probably recently. And there's just been a lot of a sentimental attachment to that store. This book has done exceptionally well. We weren't really expecting it, because we always feel like if a landmark is no longer in use, is it realistic to bank on nostalgia? Well, it is, because so many people have fond memories of this.
Right, right. There's so much. There's associations wrapped up in perhaps going shopping with mom and dad, or mm-hmm. being there for a special occasion, or whatever it is. While I'm holding in my hand here, Duck Hunting on Currituck Sound, Tales from a Native Gunner, and I can't even imagine going duck hunting, but nevertheless, I imagine is that like any activity like this, the stories are what count.
Absolutely.
You know, people's sense of adventure, probably, that goes with it. And are there duck hunting communities elsewhere in the country, or is this specifically to this area here in, is it North Carolina, I guess?
Well, I will say that there are, as far as I know, in my territory, there are not large duck hunting communities, and this book would never work here, but it works in the South. You know, and we see books that come through our Southern commissioning team all the time, and we think, my God, I can't believe that this book is a possibility, but it really is, and it's really, it's all about the regional audience. So Maple Sugaring in Vermont is an example of a book that probably would only work in Vermont and is inconceivable in the South. So
well, your office is in Salem, and I visited it. It's right downtown, and so probably every October you're surrounded by all the festivities, if I can call it that go with being in Salem. And you mentioned to me a kind of compare and contrast between two titles, and in fact, they kind of relate to Salem and how people tell the stories of that. There was a title you had called Murder and Mayhem, and there was something else about Wicked.
Mm-hmm.
One worked, one didn't, and why not?
Well, so we have a Murder and Mayhem series. We also have a Wicked series. And what's interesting is that the Wicked series does very, very well. It's essentially the same subject as far as I'm concerned. But the Wicked books have an entirely different cover treatment. And it's just remarkable how cover treatment can influence sales. And more so than content. And so the cover treatment in our Wicked books is very quirky, it's colorful, it's not threatening, it sells very well in gift stores, it sells well in independent bookstores and in chain bookstores. And so it really works on many in many retail settings. Whereas our Murder and Mayhem books, if you have one splash of red across the cover and the phrase "murder and mayhem," it's an entirely different ball game. You know, gift stores, they don't want to sell the book, and a Hallmark store is not comfortable with that. If you're doing a book on the Cape and you've got a lot of kind of gifty, touristy sales channels, they're just not going to be able to move copies the way they could if you just kind of made it seem like being wicked was really actually kind of fun and cute.
Right. I was thinking that there's a fun element, and that's certainly what goes along with Salem. I mean, the people who come to Salem in October are there for the fun, most of them anyway. There might be a few, and you might have seen them pass by your office window who are there for serious reasons, more to do with mayhem. But I think most people are there for the fun, and that might be a good lesson there. If you've got a title or a subject that really kind of gets people going and brings a smile to their face, that's potentially more successful than one that might make them frown. We've been talking with Saunders Robinson here at the Boston University Bookstore for a program for the National Writers Union, and I want to just sum up something here, and that is, you know, the connection these days between the web and book publishing is stronger than ever, and, showing off your expertise is perhaps easier than ever because you don't necessarily have to show published works, but if you've put together a blog and really have devoted yourself to that blog on a subject, whether it might be a certain department store or a certain regional style of cooking or anything like that, you can pretty much on your own create that kind of bona fides that will convince History Press, at least, that this is a worthwhile topic.
It is possible, certainly. I mean, you know, if you're very active on your blog, then you're engaged in writing in some way. And if you've got a blog about all things, you know, all things Connecticut, then, you know, we're certainly interested in talking to you. I did speak with some of my editors to find out what their experience had been as far as making, actually finding and contracting writers who have very active blogs. And while I will say that obviously bloggers are very engaged in updating their blog, some of my editors did say that because they were so involved in their blog, they didn't think that they had any time to devote to book projects, which I thought was kind of surprising. But I think that, you know, I think it can go either way. If you're obsessed with your blog, you may not have time for putting together a more serious book. But if you're really active and are already generating the material, it can be a really great way of promoting your book and engaging the rest of your community and any of your readers that are and will probably become a built-in audience.
Right, right. I have to say that brings a smile for two reasons. One, I just try to imagine a blogger who's been so obsessed with their work that they couldn't be convinced to write a book because you'd think that would be a relief to them. But then I was also imagining maybe 25 years from now or 50 years from now, History Press will be publishing books that will take a nostalgic look back at the blogs of the early days of the 21st century. That'll be fun to see. Saunders Robinson, who is the senior commissioning editor and Northeast publisher for the History Press, based in Salem, Massachusetts, thank you very much for chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to everyone in the audience listening. And on behalf of the National Writers Union, the steering committee at the Boston chapter, and as well for Beyond the Book, a podcast series of the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. This is Chris Keneally, and thank you very much for listening.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.